Bonsoir, je m'excuse. Je suis un peu désolé, j'ai préparé un texte en anglais, puisque ma connaissance du français est un peu trop passive, pas assez actif pour m'exprimer très bien sur ces choses-là. Mais peut-être dans la discussion, on peut parler le français. De Tiberine Case, le film Les hommes et les dieux, présente un challenging process of decision-making. No ethical principle obliges the monks to stay in their abbey. They prefer, after a period of reflection and deliberation, the option to stay and running the risk of death over the option to leave their abbey and being secure. On the other hand, the choice of the monks is not irrational. If it is their what's called meta-preference, their preference to prioritize the love of God over the self-love and the love of neighbors over self-security, the choice to stay seems to be rational and very consistent. Most economists will consider the choice of the monks, I think, as a rational choice, given their spiritual and altruistic view of life. The case evokes many questions. First, is it right to explain the decision of the monks as a rational choice? Another question, is it reasonable and realistic to use the Tiberine model of decision-making as an example for managerial and entrepreneurial decisions? Why should we go for altruism or promote spirituality if business can only flourish in a context of enlightened self-interest and competitive success? So that's already two not so easy questions to answer. So here you have an overview of the questions I want to tackle during my brief reflections. First, I will try to demonstrate that spirituality is not a form of rational altruism, or it cannot be reduced to rational altruism. I think there is something very different in a human commitment that is not well explained in the rational choice theory. In the second and third session, I will question the meaning of spirituality. What do we mean by spirituality, and why do we need spirituality in managerial decision making? In this section, I will follow the argument of Fritz Schumacher, saying that we need, in a business context, in a managerial context, spirituality to solve what he calls divergent problems. You will see what kind of problems this is. The fourth and fifth section explores the modus operandi of spiritual discernment. During the Christmas holiday period, I read Hannah Arendt again, her lectures on Kant's political philosophy. And there is a very interesting theory of judgment, of how to make decisions, in that book. And I will refer to her theory of judgment and to see what are the links with the decision-making process of the monks. And in my last point, I will try to give some indications on how spiritual judgment or spiritual discernment can renew the practice of business ethics or leadership ethics. Yeah. Are the monks rational altruists? A set economist will say that given the monks option for altruism, running a deadly risk to help other people is just as rational as is the option to leave the country for persons who consider safety and security as their first priority. An analogous rational pattern of self-sacrifice can be found, for example, in the behavior of some radical Muslims willing to offer their lives on earth in exchange for an eternal and happy life in paradise. At the end, that's the logic of rational choice theory, all human beings are looking for a maximum of bliss and happiness, and hence behave as a rational and calculating homo economicus. I think the flaw, it's not so easy to see the flaw in that type of argument. And I think the flaw in this classical economic argument is the meaning of happiness. Economists define happiness as the maximization of pleasure or maximization of utility that results from the realization of our needs and preferences given the constraints of time and scarce resources. We can easily agree that a lot of pleasure comes from this realization of our needs and preferences. But I think there is another and not less important source of happiness that comes from the quality of human relations. Family relations, authentic friendship, good professional relations with colleagues and peers, etc. The key point here is to see that the quality of human relations and the happiness resulting from it does not follow from the practice of maximizing pleasure. And let me illustrate that with an example, the example of friendship. If you define friendship as the maximization of pleasure drawn from an encounter with a friend, we would reduce the presence of a friend to a means for maximizing my own happiness. Most of us will realize that such an approach is deemed to fail. A flourishing friendship needs at least a tacit commitment to keep the friendship alive, even if it implies a cost in terms of pleasure. Too much focus on maximizing feelings of pleasure undermines the genuine commitment of the relation. This makes clear that the source of endurable friendship does not lie in the fulfillment of our own need of affection. I try to maximize my need of affection, but in the reciprocal commitment to endorse each other's life in good and bad days. So it's important to see this difference. It's a bit of a subtle argument to see happiness as maximizing your own preferences, even if these preferences are altruist preferences, and a commitment that has nothing to do with maximizing pleasure, but is a commitment to endorse each other's life in good and bad days. We will come back to that. From the example of friendship, we may learn that human happiness has a dual nature. It partly results from our said rational capability of maximizing pleasure, but just as important is the spiritual capability of self-gift and reciprocal commitment. Hence, we should complete the rational theory of happiness with a spiritual approach. The rational theory, based on maximizing pleasure or minimizing displeasure, presupposes an active and egocentric subject. I mean by egocentric, not selfish or egoistic, but egocentric, focused on maximizing its own preferences. The spiritual theory of happiness discloses the pleasure that results from being deeply related to the other. The assumed subject here is the spiritual or interconnected self. The spiritual self does not maximize anything. It is a form of self-awareness that precedes rational thinking and rational choice. In our culture, we may observe the tension between the two ways of searching for happiness. On the one hand, we hear the voice of the rational self claiming for always more and bigger. On the other hand, we hear the voice of the spiritual self claiming for less and better. So if... Oh, sorry, that's not... Yeah. If spirituality is not rational altruism, or something more than that, what is it? How can we define spirituality? When we started the Space Network was a network aimed at promoting spirituality in economic and social life. We defined spirituality as people's multiform search for meaning, interconnecting them with all living beings and to God or ultimate reality. That was our working definition when we started our network. The key word of this definition is interconnecting. And I believe that this is the hallmark for an experience-based definition of spirituality. However, I would like to suggest a somewhat lighter version of the earlier definition as follows. Spirituality is a way of thinking and living that originates from deep and personal experiences of interconnectedness. That's the way I try to define spirituality. This statement focuses on two points. First, the origin of spirituality lays in deep and personal experiences of interconnectedness. Interconnectedness with yourself, with nature, with other people, and with the source of life. These experiences can take many shapes, many forms, but they all have in common a deep sense of being part of a greater whole or flow. The second point in that definition is that spirituality implies a specific way of thinking and living. Without critical reflection, thinking, or concrete practices, spirituality runs the risk to fall in subjectivism and escapism. A spiritual person has to integrate his spiritual experiences with the claims of intellectual and rational life without reducing the one to the other. So far about this definition. That's a bit a general definition of spirituality, but the focus of this session is how can we approach spirituality in the domain of decision making. In his Spiritual Exercises in 16th century, Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit, distinguishes two ways of arriving at a good decision. The first relies on the ratio, which lists the advantages or disadvantages of each option so as to weigh up what in the long term would be the most favorable solution. I think this is the type of cost-benefit analysis that is very well known for all. That's at the core of economics. The second method he calls the discernment of the spirits. Basically, this approach entails the individual examining his deeper moods and feelings and discerning which of the moods associated with the options leads to an inner enlargement of the spirit, what he calls dilatatio, the enlargement of the spirit, and feelings of inner peace, consolatio. So the good decision is the one who enlarges our spirit and gives us a deep feeling of peace. I think it's this way of discernment and deliberation which is so nicely illustrated in the Tiberin case. The question now is, do we need the second method, discernment of spirits, or spiritual discernment, in management? An interesting argument has been given here by, I mentioned him already, Fritz Schumacher, the well-known author of Small is Beautiful. In his last book, The Guide for the Perplexed, Schumacher makes a very relevant distinction between two kinds of problems, convergent and divergent problems. Convergent problems are problems that can be designed and solved as technical or rational problems, bringing in all the available information. You can apply a kind of algorithm and find an optimal solution. And there is one optimal solution. On the contrary, divergent problems cannot be solved by such a procedure of optimization. Because the actors think and act from very different and opposite value premises. Schumacher illustrates this with the case of education, where those who are primarily committed to the value of freedom will always defend in the discussions non-authoritarian solutions to educational problems, while people primarily committed to the value of order will always argue in favor of more discipline and more obedience on the part of the pupils. So depending on your value, you will prefer one solution or another. There is not an optimal solution. How to solve that kind of problems? When you have divergent interest, divergent values, because that are the difficult problems. And also in the film, the monks had in the beginning divergent positions on the question to leave or to stay. To be solved, such divergent problems require a capacity to engage in an empathic dialogue in order to disclose common ground for action. I give you a quote from Schumacher. Divergent problems cannot be solved in the sense of establishing a correct formula. They can, however, be transcended. A pair of opposites, like freedom and order, or maybe, for instance, in the European Union, sometimes solidarity against discipline, are opposites at the level of ordinary life, but they cease to be opposites at a higher level, the really human level, where self-awareness plays its proper role. It's then that such higher forces as love and compassion, understanding and empathy become available, not simply as occasional impulses, which they are at a lower level, but as a regular and reliable resource. End of the quote. The point of Schumacher is that managing divergent problems requires well-trained capacities of self-reflection, open communication, dialogue, and understanding. In his view, spirituality as a method of solving or managing divergent problems should be part of an enlarged concept of social sciences, because spirituality for him is connected with intuitive thinking, with dialogue, with a space of open communication, co-creation of meaning, etc. However, Schumacher does not tell us much about the modus operandi of spirituality as a method of solving problems. I said reading recently Hannah Arendt, it says on Kant's political philosophy, there I found a kind of a theory of judgment inspired by Kant's Kritik der Urteilskraft, Kritik of Judgment, the third Kritik of Kant, which is not so well known. We know a lot about Kant's Kritik of pure reason and Kant's Kritik of moral reasoning, but a very fascinating aspect of Kant is his third Kritik, the Kritik of Judgment. And that's what we will explore here a bit further. Maybe it's interesting to just tell a bit the background of Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt is well known. Also, Idil refers to Hannah Arendt at a certain moment. Hannah Arendt was born into a secular family of German Jews in Linden, Hanover, at this moment. And she grew up in Königsberg. Königsberg, which was a very multicultural and also university city at that time. And as we all know, Kant is born in Königsberg and has written there his three critiques. And so it's not so surprising that Hannah Arendt is very much inspired by Kant's philosophy. At the University of Marburg, she studied philosophy with Martin Heidegger, but she studied more than philosophy. She embarked also on a long and stormy romantic relationship with Heidegger, for which she later was criticized because of Heidegger's support for the Nazi party when he was rector at the University of Freiburg. For her doctoral dissertation, she moved to Heidelberg, where she wrote a thesis on the concept of love in St. Augustine. She did it, her promoter was the existentialist philosopher Karl Jaspers. Being a Jewish, she was arrested and briefly imprisoned by the Gestapo in 1933. However, she could escape and fled Germany for France. But after having been again a prisoner in a French deportation camp during the Vichy regime, she left France for the United States. And in 1950, she became a naturalized American citizen. And in America, she served as a visiting scholar at all the famous universities of California, Berkeley, Harvard, etc. She died in 1975 at the age of 69 of a heart attack. Hannah Arendt has written a lot of well-known books. Maybe the best known is the Human Condition, La Condition Humaine. But I will focus only on those who are relevant for theory of judgment. And there are two books which are very relevant here. The first is her contributions as a journalist for The New Yorker. And these contributions of the Eichmann process for The New Yorker has been published in a book, a very controversial book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. In that book, she coined the phrase, the banality of evil. And she raised the question of whether evil, such as the Holocaust, for instance, is a radical evil or simply a function of thoughtlessness. And she came to the conclusion that the process of Eichmann illustrates the existence of a type of social evil that results from thoughtlessness, the tendency of people to obey orders and to conform to mass opinion without any critical judgment. So her discovery of the banality of evil awoke her interest in the human faculty of judging. If a lack of judgment leads to unthinkable evil, how can judgment help us to make good moral decisions? In her last and unfinished work, The Life of Mind, she intended to explore that question. She finished two parts of the book, about the first about thinking, the second about willing, but she never wrote the last and most challenging part about judgment. A few days before her death, she had introduced a new and blanco page in her typewriter with the title Judging and two quotations. And that was all. That was part three. She died from the heart attack. However, Arendt did leave some manuscripts and notes for a series of lectures on Kant's political philosophy. And in these writings, we find her unfinished theory of judgment. What can we learn from Hannah Arendt's analysis? I will briefly focus on three points. First, the difference between reasoning, moral reasoning, and judging. For her, that's a two very different things. Then, two, what's the role of taste, imagination, and feelings in the process of judgment? And three, how to validate our feelings of taste. After having ended the parts on thinking and willing of her latest book, The Life of Mind, Hannah Arendt wrote a postscriptum where she made it clear what makes judgment different from reasoning. I quote, "I shall show that judgments are not arrived by either deduction or induction," the traditional methods of reasoning, deduction, induction. "In short, they have nothing in common with logical operations. We shall be in search of the silent sense, which, when it was dealt with at all, has always, even in Kant, been thought of as taste, and therefore as belonging to the realm of aesthetics." According to Arendt, end of the quote, according to Arendt, reasoning is based on induction or deduction. In inductive reasoning, we try to observe as many cases as we can in order to find a general principle that can be tested on its general validity by predicting future events. That's a traditional procedure in scientific research. In deduction, we subsume a particular event under a general law. And in moral reasoning, we do a similar thing. We try to see if our particular behavior can be subsumed under a general moral principle in order to legitimate our behavior. Kant's critique of moral reasoning was a search to find the most general principles or moral laws that inform and legitimate moral behavior. Now, if we are able to subsume facts or decisions under a general principle or law, we do not need to judge things. You do not need to judge, you have just to follow the reasoning. There is a compelling logic in a reasoning. But as we have seen, in the case of divergent problems, there is no such universal principle available or no shared interpretation of such a principle. And in these difficult situations, we cannot reason, but we have we need another faculty than a reasoning to judge the situation and to make a decision. Kant originally intended to call his third critique the critique of taste, instead of critique of Urteilskraft, critique of judgment. Contrary to the senses as seeing, hearing, and touching, we present the objects of the outer world. The senses of us seeing, hearing, and touching present the objects of the outer world in a direct and objective way. But in smelling and tasting, we have our inner sensations and do not see directly, we cannot describe it so easily as objective. Therefore, we often say, de gustibus non est disputandum. Smelling and tasting may give me feelings of it pleases me or displeases me, but it's difficult to communicate them in an objective way as we do with the other senses. However, de gustibus non est disputandum, but we like to communicate our feelings of taste. Through empathy, we imagine the feelings of other people. And by sharing and testing our aesthetic judgments with other people, we enlarge our mind and enjoy what Kant calls a contemplative pleasure, which is the aim of sharing aesthetic judgments, according to Kant. Now, it's important to see the difference between the utilitarian and the aesthetic feelings of pleasure and displeasure. Utilitarian feelings, that's most economics refer to the utilitarian feelings of pleasure and displeasure, are derived from the egocentric satisfaction of our needs and from the reduction of things to their functional use or instrumental use. Aesthetic feelings of pleasure are disinterested. They do not reveal things as functional but as non-functional, as intrinsic beautiful and right in their own appearance. According to Arendt, the activity of taste, which is the basis for judgment, taste, not reasoning, taste, the activity of taste decides how this world, independent of its utility and our vital interest in it, is to look and to sound. Its interest in the world is purely disinterested. Kant would say it's purely contemplative pleasure. While Kant's analysis of taste as the basis for judgment was applied to aesthetics, Hannah Arendt was convinced that we can extend the model of aesthetic judgment to moral and social judgment. However, can we trust our subjective feelings in moral choices? Do they have some general validity? So that's this. And all the last point in this theory of judgment. Philosophers as Plato and many others always made a clear distinction between opinions, doxai, and true knowledge, episteme. Opinions are not trustworthy. Philosophy, as the search for truth, has nothing to do with opinions. Kant, as well as Arendt, do not follow Plato's contempt for opinions. They rehabilitate the value of opinions and subjective statements of taste in their theory of judgment. The core argument in their defense of the value of opinions and expressions of taste is that the statement of taste always implies communicability, and communicability requires a community of men who can be addressed and who are listening and can be listened to. This presence of at least an implicit and virtual community makes it possible to transform our individual opinions into judgments of common sense. We try by communicating these feelings and these statements of taste, and we test and to see how we can form a common sense. And therefore, for Arendt and also for Kant, the freedom to communicate is essential to develop a kind of a common sense feeling. And I found a very nice quote from Kant to express that idea, which is very, I think, very nice in the light of the terrorist events in Paris. Kant, here a quote of Kant. It is said, the freedom to speak or to write can be taken away from us by the powers that be, but the freedom to think cannot be taken from us through them at all. However, and that's the interesting point, how much and how correctly would we think if we did not think in community with others to whom we communicate our thoughts and who communicate theirs to us? Hence, we may safely state that the external power which deprives man of the freedom to communicate his thoughts publicly also takes away his freedom to think, the only treasure left to us in our civic life and through which alone there may be a remedy against all evils of the present state of affairs. So Kant, and certainly Arendt, have tried to stress very much the role of public debate and the exchange of statements of taste, our feelings, our opinions, and to test them and to create a space for free communication. That is part of spiritual life for them. Arendt indicates two tracks to strengthen the communicability and hence the validity of our subjective judgment. The first one is to stimulate what she calls representative thinking in order to make present to my mind the viewpoints of those who are absent. According to Arendt, the more people's standpoints I have present in my mind while I am pondering a given issue, and the better I can imagine how I would feel and think if I were in their place, the stronger will be my capacity for representative thinking, and the more valid my final conclusions, my opinion. So I empathy, and that kind of understanding to empathy is very essential to make to give judgments a general validity. Representative thinking does not mean that I conform my judgment to the actual statements of the majority. I quote, "I still speak with my own voice, and I do not count noses in order to arrive at what I think is right, but my judgment is no longer subjective either." The other test of validity, which Arendt found in Kant, is the idea of exemplary validity. To formulate a judgment, we often use as a standard a good example or a best practice. A good example or a best practice is not a general or abstract principle. It is a particular situation, a particular person, a particular kind of behavior. So it's not something general or a general principle or law or something. But a particular case helps us to disclose a more general meaning. I quote, "The exemplar is and remains a particular that in its very particularity reveals the generality that otherwise could not be defined. Courage is like Achilles." That's a nice thing. If you want to know what's courage, it's not an abstraction. Look at Achilles. You will see something, what it means to be courageous. Now, I think 5 minutes? Yeah. Then I will stop. Yeah, sorry. Spiritual discernment in business. Let's come back to business. Can we find this theory of judgment also in a business context? I think there are many examples and stories of good and bad judgment in business. Many case studies. What is missing, however, is a good theory of moral judgment in business ethics. In most handbook of business ethics, business behavior is called to be ethical when it can be subsumed under some general ethical principle, be it the Kantian ethical imperative or a human rights idea, or a utilitarian principle of the maximum of pleasure for the maximum of people, of another kind of principle. An example, for instance, neoliberalist ethicist defending the shareholder model of the firm always demonstrate that the shareholder model is consistent with universal rights of property. That's one of their arguments. The other argument is that through the mechanism of the invisible hand, the market is able to maximize income and welfare for the majority of people. The utilitarian principle. So you see, but they try to subsume the case in the stakeholder theory. There is a shift from property rights to distributive justice rights, but it's the same reasoning. Now, the moral reasoning is fine, and we need that kind of moral reasoning, but as soon as we are confronted with the context of divergent claims and interests, again and again we see that the real decision-making slides back to a game of power and self-interest. There is no framework of moral judgment. To give an example, you know the closing of Renault in Brussels in the late 90s was for me a turning point, an eye-opener, because the case illustrated very well how a stakeholder philosophy practiced on the level of the work floor was completely absent in managing the problem of long-term profitability. It was absent there. At a higher level, there was no space or framework for moral discussion or moral judgment. I don't say that they had, probably they should close the department, but it's the way it's done, and the judgment behind it, which is failing. I think a more interesting concept that introduced a theory of moral judgment in business context and in businesses is the concept, the idea and practice of spiritual-based leadership. I will not work it out here. I try to find a bit of niche for that concept in contrasting it with other models of leadership. The only point I would like to make here is a bit the contrast between two types of spirit-driven leadership. The one is what I call an aristocratic type of leadership, and the other a democratic type of leadership. There is in the film Les Hommes de Dieu a very remarkable scene, and Odile has referred already to that scene. During the first deliberation of the monks, Frère Christian, the abbot, explained why he decided not to close the abbey, despite the attacks and threats of the extremist. And he explained it to the other monks. But some of the monks did not accept his decision. They questioned his decision. One said, "We did not choose you as an abbot to decide in our names what to do. We choose you to guide us in a process of collective decision." It was not exactly these words, but that was what. The abbot understood the critique, kept silent, and changed his role. And you see it in the film. He became a listener to the collective process of discernment. While he first was the one taking the decision, he changed his role and became a listener to the collective process of discernment. The scene illustrates very well a transition from aristocratic type of leadership based on religious and moral principles to a democratic model based on a practice of spiritual judgment and discernment. And they started in a situation where they had divergent claims and interests. And they ended, although after and during the process, to a shared collective position. Are there similar examples in the business world? I tried, and that's my last point. Yeah. I would like to give very briefly, and maybe you know the story of Oticon, a Danish multinational company well known for selling hearing aids and that kind of technologies. Until the 90s, the company was structured according to the traditional model of bureaucratic rationality. But in the beginning of the 90s, they faced a deep crisis because the dollar fell to half its value in Danish crown, and all kind of meetings were organized, but they lost control, and the eight executive directors were dismissed, and Lars Kolind, the manager of a high-tech firm, was hired as director. And in response to the crisis, he developed an ambitious vision for the group and started a process of reflection and deliberation. I think it's really a case, an example of applying the method of judgment, the theory of judgment of Hannah Arendt. Collins' basic philosophy consisted in dismantling all bureaucratic rationality and creating in its place what he called a moral free space. So a space for moral judgment, freedom, open communication, and personal responsibility. In practice, this meant the abolition of all titles and departmental structures, of fixed working hours, of clearly defined jobs. All information, apart from a few confidential details, was to be made accessible to everyone. Each person was able to make suggestions and proposals directly to Collint himself. If Collint was unavailable to receive the suggestion within 24 hours, one could claim a financial compensation for the lost time. So he did a very radical, but it was needed to solve the problem. But nevertheless, it was a difficult period because not everyone could adapt to the new style, to the Collint style, which called for a high degree of open communication and responsibility and creativity. Just as in the case of Tiberin, his leadership was not based on superior moral or economic reasoning, but on the art of listening and disclosing the human capacity of discernment and judgment in a group. He described the core of his leadership in the following way. The key lies in the notion of trust. No one can resist trust. The basic assumption that guides my notion of leadership is that a personal will only take responsibility for itself and look after the common good if management is able to create an environment that promotes trust and autonomy. I think that's enough for... oh, sorry, yeah. Thank you very much for your attention.